morning. It's Wednesday, October 19th, and we're here at KCR Studios. As always, it's the Highlander Newsroom with your host, Miles Andrew Zubé, editor-in-chief. And with me today are...
John Hammond, lead sports editor.
Faraz Rizvi, editor of the arts entertainment section.
I guess it's with me today is... that's the right grammar, right?
I'm sure nobody would have noticed.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. Unless, because I kind of put it out in the open now. A lot of stuff to talk about this week, right? Like, more fun, more lighthearted than last week. Last week we had family housing to deal with. Did we talk about childcare?
Yeah, so
a bit more lighthearted. We're going to try to get into a discussion about ASCC art first, and then Nobel Peace Prize, Bob Dylan. Maybe talk about clowns a bit. That was in our editorial for this most recent issue. Grab a copy. It's hot. And so for those who are just tuning into the show for the first time, usually what we do is representative of the Highlander newspaper. We just go around, talk about issues that are relevant to the paper, or maybe on a larger scale, or maybe just students all together, not only at UCR, but throughout the UCs and throughout other college campuses. So I think ASUCR is a good place to start with that. What's currently going on with ASUCR is, for those who don't know, the VCSA, the Vice Chancellor's Office at Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs at UCR, is looking to assume oversight over ASUCR's executive director position, and basically oversight over the decisions made in ASUCR is what it at least threatens to be. So the way this was handed out was through a letter from UCR Chancellor Kim Wilcox that basically told President Shafi Kareem, as well as the executive director Lori Sinclair and the financial operations manager Teresa Perez, that they would be assuming oversight. This was on September 19th. And since then, it's pretty much been in place. It was effective immediately. It's been in place. Vice Chancellor Jim Sandoval spoke at the recent ASUCR meeting, just kind of to hear the concerns of the ASUCR members, as well as articulate the reason for them doing this. As of, I believe, last Wednesday, the ASUCR Senate pretty much voted that they would not go through with the oversight, primarily because they believed it threatened the autonomy and it set a precedent for their constitution to be pretty much be trumped by the chancellor, what the chancellor wants to do, in a basic sense. So that's a long story, I guess, trying to bring you the short version. What are you guys' thoughts on this initially, before we dive into more direct questions?
So the VCSA trying to kind of take control of ASUCR isn't something that's new. From discussions we've had, it looks very clear that they've been trying to do this for a while. However, you know, with Wilcox coming in and placing all these changes on campus, I think this is just another extension of a problem we already went over last week. Why they would want control of ASUCR and threaten the autonomy of the student body, I don't know. It seems like it's the only place where they don't really have full control, and that brings up about kind of scary questions about what Wilcox's vision of the UC campus is. And the more we delve into it, the more things he does, it really looks like it's not in creating a safer campus or a more positive campus for the student body.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of looks like a power grab, you know, like how can, you know, the chancellor's office, how can they control more of the student body and more of, you know, the university? I mean, I don't know, like my knee-jerk reaction to that is I wouldn't want, like, if you're a part of a student org and you've got, like, the autonomy that they have, I wouldn't want that trampled on by anybody. Like Miles mentioned, like, you know, they have a constitution in place. Like, I wouldn't want anybody to come into the Highlander and try and assume control over it, trumping all of our bylaws and everything we've been doing. So, you know, even if, you know, the student body may not wholly agree with what ASUCR is trying to do, like, at the end of the day, they are still trying to bring about, like, you know, the greater good for the student body. And, you know, they should be allowed to at least go about it with their constitution and their rules.
Yeah, well, I mean, and So it's clear that you guys do believe it does threaten the autonomy of student government, not only at UCR, but from the reception that the article gathered from other UC campuses and other associated students among UC campuses particularly, it is a similar sentiment. What's interesting is that this isn't necessarily something that's unique to UC schools, with the exception of ASUCLA, but UCLA is completely, like, they are an outlier in so many respects in regards to other UCs, and their student government is much different. But there is some line of oversight from vice chancellor or administration, at least, and student government across all UCs, with the exception of UCLA. But what do you think the concerns, or not the concerns, but the biggest issues that could potentially or do automatically arise with oversight and just a loss of autonomy overall in student government?
Well, one thing is that, you know, the students' interests don't always align with those interests of the chancellor. We've seen it multiple times where there have been things, you know, resolutions passed that were critical or took a stance against the official position of the administration. And so for me, the issue is, you know, I mean, we're talking about oversight as a very broad word. What does this oversight consist of? Like, do they have the power to, you know, veto resolutions? Do they have the power to actually influence the way the student body works? Because I think if that's true, then that's definitely a very serious loss of autonomy that I think doesn't really bode well. But again, like, the details as to what this oversight entails is very different. So
right. What it is like, what, at least how they articulated it in the letter initially, was it would be a dotted line reporting and a solid line reporting between the executive director and VCSA, and a dotted line between the executive director and student government. The solid line it was very unclear. But the issue that's raised with that is, like, there's no definition of what a dotted line and solid line means, right? And I think the biggest issues that come about with this is that, one, it's given that there's so much, I think, ambiguity in what the actual parameters of their oversight would entail, and I think that what it is more so it's allowing for them to do these things, like you said, veto potential bills, or like pretty much hand down orders and commands from administration that must be followed, but through the executive director instead of directly from administration. These type of things can happen. It's just a matter of will they take the action and do it, but it puts it in their hands. I think that's the biggest concern. But John, I know you have something to say, so I'll talk after you. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, it seems like if you've got student government and you take the autonomy of the students out of it, it's not really student government anymore. You know, at what point are we making, like, is ASUCR making decisions that aren't even actually the decisions of the student body? You know, like, at what point are all of the issues that they want to tackle and all the issues they believe are relevant to us just scrapped, and it's all replaced with, you know, what the chancellors or other higher-ups want? And it doesn't seem like student government anymore. Now you're just kind of going through the motions for someone else's agenda and not for ours.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. No, I actually do agree with that. While, you know, oversight, as you mentioned, isn't something that's unique, like, this isn't the first time there will be oversight of an associated student's government by the administration. At Berkeley, they do. At Santa Barbara, they do. You know, a number of different UCs, they do. But I still think those UCs aren't UC Riverside. And what makes UC Riverside, you know, kind of unique is our progressive atmosphere and how forward the student body has been in leading change. You know, and this is change that has not always been in the same agenda as that of the administration.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said earlier, it's even been critical of the administration. And so at what point does this constitute a power grab that will kind of threaten that atmosphere that we've been so, you know, great in creating?
Right,
and UC's greatness.
Yeah, and like, I mean, particularly, it worries me because we at the Highlander are independent, student run, but we are overseen by ASUCR to an extent, right? Where, you know, not that this, you know, current chancellor regime would, but what if, you know, how does this prevent future chancellors from doing this down the line, because no matter what, Chancellor Wilcox is not going to be in place forever, right?
Right.
How's this? This kind of paves the way for, okay, what if we can overtake ASUCR, so we have control of ASUCR, what other organizational camps do we not have control of? And, you know, the Highlander would fall under that. Because this is kind of what it seems like. It's more a power grab, like, you know, you alluded to, than any real, than there being really any real obvious need for them to do so, right? And I think the biggest issue that also comes up, and it was raised at the ASUCR, it was a closed session between Vice Chancellor Sandoval and the Senate, that the biggest thing that was raised was in the construct of the ASUCR Constitution, it says explicitly that the reporting structure in which the Vice Chancellor's office cited as an issue in noncompliance with university policy, which includes the executive director being overseen by the student body president, which means the executive director, she is a non-student and she is a UCR employee, right? And mm-hmm. the student body president is not under that category, but she was overseen by him, currently President Shafi Kareem. They said that was in non-compliance, right? But the ASUCR Constitution allows for that. It says explicitly this is a reporting structure that is allowed. And not only that, but within the PECOS, basically the Constitution and the bylaws that the Chancellor's Office abides by, it says that student government must abide by their own Constitution, right?
Right.
So it's like, what trumps what in this case? Because obviously the Chancellor has executive power, in any case, but this is basically them going against something, meaning administration going against something in their bylaws and forcing ASUCR to change what's in their own constitution, right?
Right.
And I think that's a big issue, is just to know that these things are so malleable when it comes to just an executive decision that the Chancellor wants.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems like selective enforcement. Like, if they've got it in their constitution, and obviously somebody had to ratify that constitution, they've been doing it for as long as they have, why all of a sudden is now the time to like come in and change it? Like, why all of a sudden does Chancellor Wilcox believe, okay, now we have to step in? Like, I mean, I could understand, like, maybe if ASUCR reached out for the help, I could understand him wanting to come in and assume oversight like this, but I just don't see, like, why, if they've already got their constitution saying that they're allowed to do what they're doing, mm-hmm. why is it all of a sudden now not in compliance?
Miles, just a really quick question.
Yeah.
Has the VCSA expressed any specific reason as to why they're doing this now, or is it just kind of like, you know, that as well unclear?
Well,
because
yeah.
I haven't really seen any expressed need for it.
The explicit reason, according to the audit, was investigation was conducted due to what was deemed a whistleblower complaint, primarily based on the fact that ASUCR last year wanted to back pay former Senate members and former ASUCR members, right? And then they saw that as, okay, that's a red flag that come up. And that led to a broader investigation. And what was found from the broader investigation from the Chancellor's Office and through the audit was basically what I just alluded to about the non-compliance with university policy and their reporting structure was the biggest thing. But again, there's so much ambiguity with, like, okay, so what trumps what in this case? If this was a reporting structure that we allowed for and that is also allowed by your own bylaws that you abide to, then where's the real issue? That's the biggest question. So that's pretty much what, to answer your question, that's what it is. It was what they cited, at least, was the noncompliance with university policy and their reporting structure. Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, the issue of the audit with back pay, I mean, I think that does merit, you know, some kind of consideration as to, you know, the structure of ASUCR.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, to kind of commandeer, you know, the student body in this way seems largely, not only, I mean, legality aside, by the bylaws of both parties, it just seems really unethical.
Yeah,
it's, like I said, it just seems really, really power grabby. Like, it just seems like there's, I don't know, I don't want to say like nefarious motives there, but it just doesn't seem like it's like they're doing that for our best interest. It kind of seems like the Chancellor's Office is probably doing it for the Chancellor's Office best interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we've all kind of come to that resounding sentiment there. And yeah, and again, to be clear, I believe just 2 days ago, the ACCR did come to an agreement that they will not follow the chancellor's decision and want to, you know, fight it. But the only issue is that it's been in place for about a month now. So it's a bit retroactive to fight now, as opposed to last year when the same thing happened. It was fought pretty much immediately and won by President Ashley Hirano. So this is still something that's developing in that case. You want to add one more thing in?
Yeah, just one more thing. I'm just going back on that. I mean, the issue of the audit that they, you know, used as a means to kind of commandeer ASUCR, that seems just like a reason that they were looking for, because it seems like this is not the first time this has happened. And I think that in itself is also a pretty big red flag, but unfortunately we don't really have more time to cover it, so.
Yeah, it's we're still going to be looking into it. So again, it's a developing story, but we can get to something a bit more lighthearted. Our recent editorial in this most recent issue 5 already, volume 65, issue 5. Clowns is the type of our editorial, and the title is we are an award-winning newspaper. I don't know why that became a tongue twister. We are an award-winning newspaper, and we're talking about clowns is the title of our editorial, and it is as straightforward as it can be. We had an editorial where the board discussed, like, what is the impact or any impact of basically the trend, or if you want to deem it more so a meme, is probably more accurate, of people dressing up as clowns and pretty much just walking around. Are they threatening? Some are threatening people. Some are just casually walking around as clowns, just with the motive to, I think, scare people. And it's going on all over the nation, right? Like, right, primarily, primarily on college campuses, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah.
And so is this a fad, or is there something greater here, you guys think, than just deeming it a meme, or is it just something that's going to eventually die out after Halloween?
I mean, we'll see. You know, okay. The thing with memes is that they always eventually die out.
Right.
So if it turns into something more serious, we'll know that it's not a meme. But I just think it's very bizarre, right? Like, what a world we live in. My brother kind of, you know, he's like 13 years old. He's 10 years younger than me. And he was horrified at the idea of, like, these clowns coming and getting him. And it was just, it's so weird, you know, that this is a serious issue that people are seriously afraid of. Which, like, I don't blame them. Clowns are creepy. They just definitely are, right?
Right.
But, you know, the fact that this is becoming such an issue where we need an editorial on it is kind of like...
It's ridiculous, right?
Oh, right.
That's pretty much what we... Yeah, it's explicitly what we said in the editorial. Go ahead, John.
I mean, like, as someone who's, like, never had an affliction to clowns, like, I know, like, when you grow up, everyone's like, oh, I'm afraid of clowns. I'm just someone who's never been afflicted by clowns in any way. I just think it's... I definitely think it's probably a meme at this point. But I do love how it's... I'm assuming it started in America, just because it's America. But I have seen that, like, it's even spread to, like, London and England and stuff like that. And now there's actually a guy in England dressing up as Batman hunting the clowns, as if, like, they're his Joker, and he's assumed the role of Batman and is going around. I mean, I think it's basically just real-life internet. I don't think this is going to last. Like, I don't think people are going to continue to do this for a long period. I mean, how long would you guys say this has been going on? About, like, maybe not quite a month. This has been, like, a quote-unquote clown epidemic.
Yeah, barely a month. And the issue is that, you know, one thing that I was kind of wondering was that, like, there was a question we were going over is, are any of these guys really dangerous? I haven't seen any police reports or any reports where clowns have actually assaulted anyone. You know, I know clowns have been assaulted, and there were, you know, police warnings that if you come across clowns, do not, you know, assault them or do mm-hmm. not.
Yeah.
You know, so I wonder if, you know, we're really more dangerous than the clowns are.
Yeah, I feel like we're more dangerous to the clowns.
And that's what my biggest thing, I think that's what's going to make it die out, is not the clowns just being, you know, people being numb to it, but more so the fact that they don't want to get hurt. You know, they don't want to risk their own lives. It's not like us being scared more so than them. So I think it's something that's going to last maybe through Halloween and then die out after that. Because, like, how much longer... It would be interesting. Like, how much longer can we be scared of these things until they're just within our... fabric of society. Right. We just casually just see, you know, it's just a very casual thing. We just see,
oh, yeah, there's the neighborhood clown.
Yeah, no, like, and then that would just, you know, that would just turn America upside down, I think. But
I just think Halloween is going to be a very, it's going to be a very weird Halloween.
It is. Are you guys going out for Halloween? Because I don't think I'm planning on doing that.
Like, I don't know. I mean, like, I haven't done it in a while, but, you know, just with this clown epidemic going on, I'm kind of curious to see how it's going to be. I feel like it's going to be wild.
Yeah, I want to go out now, especially just for the, just to see how it is, just see how many, because obviously there'll probably be more clowns out, and I just want to see the reaction that people are going to have, and just the chaos that will ensue.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, yeah. Like, half, yeah, I'm half a mind to, like, dress up as a clown.
Right, yeah, I'm tempted.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like it's already oversaturated a bit,
right,
so, like, we're probably going to be numb to it. Have you guys seen one at all? So
no,
I haven't seen one.
No.
So, I mean, it's a lot different.
I also think a lot of the reports are, like, staged, right? Like, uh-huh. I think this is kind of just something that was staged, an internet thing that just got way out of hand.
Do it for the gram, you know?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, well, it's a fun discussion to have, I suppose. It's a lot more lighthearted.
Well, we'll see how this goes after Halloween. Yeah. We'll see if anybody, like, after Halloween, if people are dressing up as turkeys, you know, for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, as of now, it's lighthearted. Who knows? After Halloween, hopefully nothing crazy happens.
Yeah, we hope not. We hope not. You want to introduce this next topic for us? We're going to transition here.
Yeah. So, you know, our next discussion was about Bob Dylan, you know, Nobel laureate. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature. He's the first American to win it in over 23 years. And this one's been kind of controversial. It's, you know, Bob Dylan is a legend, a singer-songwriter, and he was given the award for, I don't remember the exact statement that the Swedish Academy put out, but it was something like for creating new expressions within the great American song tradition or something along those lines. And so the issue is within, you know, the literary community, this has been kind of controversial. Did Bob Dylan deserve to win it? Is he a writer, right? I mean, do lyrics count as literature? And so these are kind of ideas that have been, you know, being mulled over by writers and thinkers all over the world.
I mean, I think there is some merit to him winning, because you could make the, you know, the analogy, like, okay, he's a songwriter. And I know, like, what me and you talked about before the show is, you know, you don't appreciate song lyrics without the music as well. But at the same time, like, song lyrics are basically just an extension of poetry, and poetry originated as being, you know, orally recited to music. So, like, I think, you know, song lyrics kind of go along the lines of poetry and, you know, art in that sense. And I think, you know, it could be, I definitely think there's a case for it. Like, I think, like, really profound song lyrics can function as life-changing literature.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Dylan, his impact is clearly resonated throughout, you know, modern music as well. And I think that's one of the biggest, to me, that's one of the things that is consistent with Nobel Prize winners, right, is that there's something lasting there, right, with something they've done. And like you mentioned before we started recording, for us, like, we usually do not know the names of these Nobel Prize winners, right, like, especially, at least in America. And so this is definitely different terrain, but to me, I think it's something encouraging in terms of it's expanding the more module definition of what literature is, right, in a way.
Right, definitely. And I'm of the opinion that Bob Dylan totally deserved it. I'm, like, the biggest fan of Bob Dylan, but, you know, as someone who's really invested in, you know, I'm a big reader, and so I think the issue does become, out of, you know, he's the first American to win it in a long time, and that's something definitely to be proud of as an American. But I think, on the other hand, there are other Americans who I think definitely deserve it, perhaps more so. You know, I mean, I can think of John Ashbery, Philip Roth, Don DeLillo. Those are all really big writers who haven't won it, but I think have made contributions to literature and poetry that will be far more lasting than Bob Dylan's. And that's not to say that Bob Dylan doesn't deserve it and that his influence isn't lasting. But, I mean, like, now we're going to see Bob Dylan is kind of in the same canon as people like W.B. Yeats and Ezra Pound and, you know, T.S. Eliot and these guys that we read and think about as, you know, the innovators of literature. And does he really deserve that title? I mean, that's something that, you know, I think it's awesome that they gave it to him, just because, you know, I do believe that lyrics and songwriting can constitute a form of literature,
mm-hmm.
even if it's not as expressive or, you know, intense as, like, lyrical poetry. But, I mean, are we ever going to see a filmmaker win it for a screenplay he wrote? Like, is that possible?
Right. And I think this maybe opened the door for that. Maybe. Yeah. But is that a good thing is the question, right? I mean, is it?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I think there are definitely, you know, there are a lot of writers that, there's so many writers in the world, and to, like, weigh the Nobel as the most important award you can win is kind of neither here nor there, because it gets, like, becomes a political game. You know, mm-hmm. we were discussing earlier the permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy that gives out the Nobel Prize in Literature. They had said before this in 2012 that we are not planning on giving it to an American anytime soon because American literature is too insular. It
right.
doesn't participate in the greater dialogue of world literature. And so, and you know, this does also get into political terrain. Like, this is an election where Donald Trump is running, Hillary Clinton is running. You know, people are really dissatisfied with, you know, politics in general and the political landscape. Bob Dylan kind of made his career off that, right? I mean, he was a very political singer-songwriter of his time. His lyrics have been monumental in kind of capturing the angst and the, you know, spirit of rebellion in his right. in the counterculture during right. his time. So it does also look like a very politically motivated, you know, award.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like Miles said, I definitely think this opens a door for, you know, like you said, other singer-songwriters, screenwriters, playwrights. And I don't really think that's necessarily a bad thing. Just because, like I said, like, you probably shouldn't pigeonhole literature to just, like, if it's not in a book, it's not literature. Like, I think, you know, if it's written word like that, or if it's, like, even if it's, like, a profound story, like an original, you know, playwright, original screenwriter, I think that, like, if it resonates with people and it, like, brings a particular struggle to light, or it just, you know, when after you see it or you read it, you take something really profound away from it, I think that should be constituted as literature. You know, if a writer or an author is expressing themselves, either like a song or in, you know, a novel or in a play, I think that should all just be construed as expression, and it doesn't matter if it's a book or not.
Right, and I totally agree with that. But here's the irony of the Nobel Prize in Literature. Very few poets tend to win it. It's really heavily skewed. Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. Very few poets tend to win. It's very skewed towards prose, novels, you know, nonfiction. Like last year was the first time a nonfiction writer won it. The year before that, a novelist won it. So we tend to see a lot of novelists win it. And relatively few poets, just because poets tend to not have, like, international reputations and statures.
Right.
The same level as novelists. Like, for example, if you asked someone on the street, can you name a single living poet? No one would be able to think of anything for the most part. If you ask them, can you name a novelist? People could say, you know, Stephen King.
J.K. Rowling,
right? Like, so literature does tend to get skewed away from poetry, which is the irony. And so to give it to, like, a songwriter with such a massive reputation, everyone practically knows who Bob Dylan is, right? Like, he's almost a household name in some respects.
Yeah.
And so that's, like, another big issue, is that by giving it to such a lauded writer and, you know, singer and artist already, are we kind of furthering this trend of not giving it to poets, which is ironic because this is a literary award.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's another element that gets tossed in there. And there are a lot of discussions going on around this. It's pretty interesting to see.
It is. And it's interesting to see if the Nobel panel is able to get in touch with Bob Dylan. Apparently, they haven't been able to. The title, as the Guardian suggests here, Nobel panel gives up knocking on Dylan's door. So that's I like the wit
right.
from the Guardian. But that's really interesting. I wonder what his... I'm really curious to see what his response is to this.
So far, he's literally had none.
Like, right. He's literally had none, exactly.
Yeah,
so.
He performed at the desert trip this weekend, and he performed, but he hasn't, you know, said anything, which is, I think, like, the most Bob Dylan thing in the world to do.
Oh, yeah.
Win
it
the
is.
Nobel Prize and just not care.
It is. And we're going to have to close out on that note. Later today, this afternoon, the Highlander will be hosting a debate between the college libertarians, or Young Americans for Liberty, college Republicans and college Democrats at the Hub, 2 to 3:30, so do stop by. It'll be moderated by Highlander editors. No time for last words, so we're just going to shout out thanks to Elliot Fawn, Monica Taylor, Louis Vandenberg, Eddie Valencia, Wolfgang Maury, and all you guys for tuning in. Peace.